Darling, give me a hand with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxen, waxen. Hear me down up there, hair, shoulder length, longer. Here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy.
Today's Please Explain is all about hair. I'm joined by Dr. Michelle Hanjani, Assistant Professor of Clinical Dermatology at Columbia University Medical Center, and by Dr. Peter Frost, Associate Researcher at the Inter-University Center for Aboriginal Studies and Research in Quebec. And we will be taking your hair-raising calls at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC. We'll be doing that a little later in the show. Right now, I'm very pleased to welcome Drs. Hanjani and Frost to my show. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Hanjani, what is hair? And what distinguishes it from fur? I mean, I'm thinking about dogs, where most dogs have fur, but some have hair. Why would one have one and the other the other?
Well, human hair is distinct from animal hair in that it's able to grow long because we have a long growth cycle. So our growth cycle in human hair is called anagen, and anagen can last anywhere from 2 to 6 years before the hair falls out and rests, and then you get a new growth cycle and a new anagen hair grows. So in humans, if your hair grows about a half inch per month, your hair can therefore over a year can grow about 6 inches, and over 6 years could grow up to 3 feet. So in animals, animals will shed cyclically once a year. So animals will have much shorter hair because they only have a 1 year long growth cycle.
Although you're only talking about hair on the head and perhaps beards, all the other hair does stop after a fairly short time.
Right. So hair, for example, on the arms and legs, the growth cycle on the human arm is probably about 1 to 3 months, and on the legs is maybe 4 to 6 months, something like that. So those hairs will be a lot shorter, and then they'll shed, and then you'll have another cycle of hair growth in those areas.
And they're made by follicles?
They are. They're made by hair follicles, and the hair follicle contains what are called stem cells that have the original cell basically for the keratinocyte, which is the cell that makes up the hair, and also another cell called a melanocyte, which is the cell that makes the color of our hair, the melanin, so the pigment of our hair. So every 2 to 6 years, when you go through a new growth cycle, your stem cells make new keratinocytes and new melanocytes to populate your new hair.
Now, back to my first question. Mm-hmm. Is there much of a difference between fur and hair?
So there are differences between the proteins, but essentially they're both made up of keratinocytes, which are the original hair building cell, and they're made up of the same proteins, the same keratins. But in animals, they're going to have animals will have genes that are slightly different from humans that go back to evolution from when the humans separated from other species.
Dr. Frost, do we know what kind of hair the first humans had?
Well, probably if we go back to Neanderthals, we're pretty sure that they had fur and not hair, because we know that they lived in a sub-zero environment, and they did not have tailored clothing. They didn't have any of the instruments that we have for making clothing that protects the skin. So they probably were very furry, like apes. And modern humans differ in that we have almost no body hair, relatively, and very long head hair. So this is a very recent evolutionary development, and it's still incomplete. If you look at older populations in Africa, in Melanesia, in New Guinea, you still see very short, curly hair. So long head hair is very, very recent, maybe 20,000 years back.
And the older hair was also black, I'm sure. When did hair color and texture start to vary among different populations?
Probably only 10 to 20,000 years ago. And we know this because in most populations, hair is black. Black is the standard. And it's only when humans entered Europe that hair color started to diversify. And you started to get red hair, flaxen hair, auburn hair, and blonde hair. And we know that this diversification is very limited in time and in space. We suspect it happened around 20 to 10,000 years ago, and it happened mainly in Northern Europe and Eastern Europe.
Does having different hair colors serve some evolutionary purpose?
Well, that's the puzzle. I call this the puzzle of European pigmentation, because this happened very quickly. It happened over a very short time period, and it also happened with eye color. And yet eye color and hair color are determined by two separate genes. So we're not looking at a common genetic cause. We're looking at a common selection pressure. And I suspect that the selection involved was sexual selection. And we see this in other animals. Wherever you have a polymorphism for color, the cause is sexual selection. You have a case where you have too many of one sex competing for too few of the other. And when you have a situation where you have to choose between several mates who are equally good, you choose the mate who stands out from the crowd, who is more colorful, and who has a color that's more novel. So you get a kind of balanced selection where the moment one color becomes too common, the selection pressure will shift to a less common color.
What happens with the great apes? They have mostly brown and black hair, although they go white as well. The same sort of thing happened there?
Yeah, they have the same gene. It's called the MC1R gene. They have the same basic gene and the same basic pigments. There are basically two pigments. One is called eumelanin, and the other is called pheomelanin. Pheomelanin creates red hair, blonde hair, and eumelanin creates black hair. And it's all these different combinations of these two pigments that creates the range of colors that we now have. But in apes, you have the one standard color. It's a standard dark color, brownish color. Whereas in humans, you have a variety of genetic variants.
Dr. Hanjani, do genes determine hair texture as well?
So genes determine mainly hair color. The texture of our hair should be fairly uniform, except not in terms of whether it's curly or wavy. That's genetically determined, but the actual texture of the hair is more dependent on external factors and what we do to our hair. And how those external factors impact the cuticle of the hair, which are these scales that coat the hair and give it the shine that we all recognize as healthy hair. Whether your hair is wavy, curly, straight, that's all determined genetically, and we don't really understand the genes that determine those things in humans.
Because with hair color, the rarer hair colors are recessive genes, right? Does that apply as well to hair, whether somebody has curly hair or straight hair? I'm assuming that straight hair is the dominant style based on the fact that, or maybe that's not true.
You know, it's not well understood what the genetics are that underlie the shape of your hair. We know that that people with very straight hair, hair that doesn't curl on cross-section, looks round, and that prevents it from taking a curl when you try to curl it. We know that that hair that's tightly coiled and tightly curled, like African hair, is elliptical in cross-section, so it's very flat. And those hairs, just to protect the hair because they're more brittle, are tightly coiled. So when those hairs are chemically straightened, then they become very weak. But we don't really know why one person has elliptical hair and one person has round. It's genetic, obviously, but we don't really know the rules that guide that.
Although we should assume, I guess, mm-hmm. because humans came from Africa, that elliptical hair was the hair of all humans for a long time.
Probably. One could speculate that.
My guests are Dr. Michelle Hanjani, Assistant Professor of Clinical Dermatology at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Peter Frost, Associate Researcher at the Inter-University Center for Aboriginal Studies and Research in Quebec. And this is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about hair on Please Explain today. Dr. Frost, why do different populations have varying amounts of hair on their bodies? For example, Scandinavians tend to have less facial hair. I would have thought that they would have wanted more because it gets colder up there.
Well, are you sure of that? I think we perceive Scandinavians as having less facial hair because the facial hair is blonder. It doesn't stand out. But if you look at the actual number of follicles, It's the same density. It just doesn't stand out against the skin.
Is hair meant to keep us warm, or are there other... Because people in... Mediterranean people often have a lot of hair, and those are warm climates.
Yeah, body hair is not very efficient for retaining body heat. In fact, if you look at Africans from sub-Saharan Africa, they have less body hair, and yet the fact that they have less body hair doesn't seem to be a cause. It doesn't seem to be a causal factor in the amount of loss of heat. The main factor is perspiration and not body hair.
So the hair helps the perspiration get off the skin and evaporate?
It's one factor, but it's a minor factor.
Why have women and men developed different patterns of body hair? Women don't have facial hair and chest hair, and they generally have less hair on their limbs as well.
Yeah, because the skin itself has become an erotic characteristic of women, and hair gets in the way. So what's happened is that the female body has become denuded in order to project a more erotic image, a smoother skin, skin that evokes the image of baby skin, actually. And there are a number of people who suggest that women have imitated the appearance of baby skin in the texture and even in the color of the skin.
So women have evolved to resemble babies in some ways?
Well, we see this even in popular culture. We talk about women having a baby face. The face is more pedomorphic. The skin is smoother. The complexion is lighter. And so it seems to suggest that there has been some kind of imitation. Perhaps one speculation is that this helps to reduce aggression in men. It makes men less aggressive. Or maybe it stimulates a parental investment by men.
Is this universal? Because there are some parts of the world where we see more facial hair on women, for example. Are they considered unattractive in those areas?
Well, I think you're talking about Mediterranean women or
mm-hmm.
the Middle East, yeah. This is because of a higher level of testosterone in women, and we don't know why. We know that even in those countries, women will shave their legs and remove their body hair. So it's not because they consider body hair to be more attractive.
Now, Dr. Hanjani, can you clear up something for me? Does shaving make body hair grow back quicker?
No, it doesn't. It makes the hair seem to be thicker, though, because instead of having tapered new hairs, you have blunt-ended hairs. So when the hairs grow in, they're noticed more quickly. So then if you were to pluck it out and the new hair were to replace it, or if you were to wax the hair, it would come in tapered, and it would appear to be a softer hair. So it doesn't come in more quickly, no.
So waxing just makes it come in the way it normally does.
Mm-hmm.
What about chemical hair removers?
So chemical hair removals work on the molecular level to stop cell division so that you don't get a new hair. They work okay. There's one on the market that works while you use it. It doesn't do it permanently. Then there are also other agents that are over the counter that are actually dissolve the hair keratins rather than work enzymatically to stop hair growth. And those also they do dissolve the hair keratins, but they can be very irritating on the skin. So some women don't like to use them.
Dr. Frost, does removing hair from the body have social significance in some cultures? You mentioned that even in cultures where women have more testosterone and grow facial hair, they tend to remove body hair.
Yeah. Well, what happens is that culture tends to ritualize and accentuate physical differences. So in the case of body hair, there is a sex difference between men and women, but it overlaps. And culture encourages people to accentuate the difference. Women remove their body hair. And in the case of head hair, you have the opposite. Women try to lengthen their hair, whereas men try to, will cut it or even shave it altogether.
Although only recently have we seen the totally bald head be an attractive thing. For a long time, men would panic when they found themselves going bald?
Well, we have parallels to this in ancient cultures. Well, I guess you've heard of the Iroquois. They would shave their heads except for a little bit on the top.
Which we call a mohawk.
Yeah, mohawk, yeah. And we get this in many warrior cultures where men will shave either part or all of their head hair in order to become more masculine, more terrifying. Because head hair is seen as being feminine. And if a man has too much of it, he is perceived as being perhaps attractive but still effeminate.
Dr. Hanjani, what causes baldness? Are all forms of alopecia related?
No, there are a variety of different types of hair loss or alopecia. The most common, probably the most common that I see would be twofold. One is pattern hair loss, which used to be called androgenetic alopecia. That's the type we recognize commonly as a balding man or a woman with slightly thinning hair. And then the second form would be something we call telogen effluvium, which is a sudden sort of diffuse shedding of the scalp hair after some sort of traumatic physical or social or life-changing event.
I know a woman who, after she gave birth to a child, lost pretty much all the hair on her body, and only some has grown back.
Yeah, so that's most likely that's telogen effluvium. I don't know her individual case, but that's pretty common. Usually during pregnancy, the hair becomes fuller and the hairs themselves become thicker. And then after pregnancy, usually about 6 weeks later, there can be a sudden shift of all the hairs out of the growth cycle, which is anagen, into telogen, which is resting. And a woman can lose dramatic amounts of her hair, but usually it recovers within a few months to a year.
But it's interesting that a man will go lose the hair on the top of his head, but his beard will remain full.
Right. So in male pattern hair loss, what used to be called androgenetic alopecia, the hair follicles on the crown, the vertex scalp, and the front of the scalp, the frontal scalp, those hairs contain an enzyme called 5-alpha reductase type 2, which converts testosterone into something called DHT, which is a stronger form of testosterone, versus these other hair follicles usually have type 1 enzyme, which isn't quite as active. So in the frontal scalp and the vertex scalp, as in a susceptible man, these areas will have higher levels of DHT, and so they have this hormonally mediated thinning of the hair.
Dr. Frost, you talked about how length of hair and color of hair and shape of hair all can have cultural significance, men being seen as effeminate if they have too much. Women being seen as masculine if they have too much. How important is hair in cultures around the world? Do all cultures really put a lot of significance into different aspects of hair?
Well, there's variation, but hair is important for all cultures. Amongst Amerindians, hair is seen as being sacred. And in East Asia, you have the same idea that it's sacred, and if you cut off your hair, like as with the monks, it's a gesture of submission. And it's the same with the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians. Children were expected to shave their heads as a gesture of submission to the parents. In the Muslim world, female hair is considered to be very powerful, and many Muslims will say that long hair in women gives them power over men, and that's why they're supposed to cover it up.
When did people start coloring their hair?
Oh, this goes back as far as we know. We know that the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Assyrians, they all dyed their hair, and the oldest form of hair dye would be henna. You may have heard of it. Mm-hmm. It gives a reddish tinge to the hair.
People still use it.
Yeah, they still use it. People would use alum, quicklime, wood ash to bleach hair, or they would just wet it. They would make it damp and then expose it to the sun, and that would make the hair blonde. And people would buy hair. There was a market in ancient Rome for hair from the Germans and from the Celts, blonde hair.
So they would get hair extensions in another color?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Were they making wigs?
Well, both. They would either extend the hair or they would buy a wig. And people do this today in Africa. It's very popular in sub-Saharan Africa to lengthen the hair either with real hair or with fibers, with fabrics, or any material that's at hand.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Dr. Peter Frost, Associate Researcher at the Inter-University Center for Aboriginal Studies and Research in Quebec, and Dr. Michelle Hanjani, Assistant Professor of Clinical Dermatology at Columbia University Medical Center. We're talking about hair on Please Explain.
I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair and send him on his way.
We're talking about hair on Please Explain today with Drs. Michelle Hanjani and Peter Frost. And taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Bernie from North Plainfield, New Jersey. Hi, you're on Please Explain. Bernie, are you there? Okay, thank you so much. We go now to Peter from Manhattan. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Leonard. I have a question for your guest and a suggestion. I think that I notice an increase in African-American women's facial hair because they take the birth control pill. That's just my theory. And that somehow changes their hormones.
Okay, well, you just came up with a theory. Let's ask Dr. Hanjani. Is that possible?
I would suggest that that's unlikely. Actually, in women who have elevated levels of testosterone, we actually treat them with birth control pills to increase their female hormone levels, and that also inadvertently suppresses some of the male hormone levels. So that reduces what we call hirsutism, which is excess hair in a woman in areas you would typically expect to see in a man.
Now, my second question is that I noticed that with Africans, their hair texture is not so much similar to animal hair as, say, Caucasians. Can you explain that? One last part. Is I was under the impression that the more curly hair is an advanced state as opposed to the straight hair. Of course, we have the apes, of course, who have the same hair as other groups, you know, around the world, not just Caucasians. But
well, I have a feeling we're getting into the area of eugenics here. But we see straight hair in certain parts of the world, for example, in Scandinavia, in Asia. But are there reasons for certain places having straighter hair and other places having curlier hair, do you think?
If I may speak?
Yes, please.
We don't really know. There are all kinds of hypotheses. You may have heard of the aquatic ape hypothesis, that humans used to be aquatic and women have long hair for babies to hang on to. But we don't know. Darwin thought that long hair was a trait that was shaped by sexual selection, but he was unable to explain why it's longer in some populations than in others.
And when we look at Asian hair, we see something interesting. It can be very thick in women and much thinner in men. We don't see a lot of baldness among Asian men, at least not as much as we do with Europeans. Are these just genetic variations?
Yeah.
That have to do with, how people evolve in different parts of the world?
Yeah, well, we know that East Asians have a lower level of DHT, and DHT is the more active form of testosterone. And we also know that men who, for one reason or another, don't have the enzyme to convert from testosterone to DHT, these men do not go bald. So we know that for East Asians, if you're an East Asian, your chances of going bald are less.
Let's take a call from Duke Center, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually a first-time caller. This is very exciting because we never get to New York City, so we can at least call into New York City.
Okay. Well, you're listening on the Internet.
I am listening on the Internet. my question was, I just finished chemotherapy treatments, and, you know, you lose all your hair, and then it grows back. And what is it about the chemotherapy that actually changes? Like, some people will have hair that grows back in curly. I actually didn't get curly hair, but it is definitely thicker, and it's different than it was before. And I was just curious as to what it was about the chemotherapy that kind of adjusted your hair follicles, or does it really, or is it just a myth?
It does often grows back in a different pattern, doesn't it, Dr. Hanjani?
Yes, so chemotherapy, the medicines used attack rapidly dividing cells, and so that includes cells that make up the blood, cells that make the hair follicle and the hair. It includes cell in the GI tract, and so in the hair follicle, the rapidly dividing stem cells that make up the melanocytes and the keratinocytes that make our hair are the stem cells are there, but the rapidly dividing daughter cells are destroyed. And so when that happens during chemotherapy, there's a shedding of the hair, and we call that anagen effluvium, because a growing anagen hair is suddenly broken and falls. And then when the hair eventually recovers off chemotherapy, there are most likely there are subtle changes to how the hair bulb is able to recover, and then that results in a slight change in the texture of the hair.
And sometimes it comes in dark when it was lighter for a while, or vice versa.
Usually comes in lighter than first, and then it may darken to what it normally was in time.
Now, why is that? First of all, let's talk about light hair that becomes dark. You have there are a lot of children who are born with very light hair whose hair darkens. Others don't. Do we have any idea why?
No, that I don't have a good answer for. In the situation of someone who has had some sort of insult to their hair follicle, like a disease process, it's just that the stem cells and the keratinocytes, the cells that make up the actual hair versus the melanocyte that makes up the pigment, the keratinocyte is able to recover more quickly than the melanocyte.
But kids are born often platinum blondes,
mm-hmm.
and then later their hair goes dark, or some go dark, some don't.
Yeah, you know, I could speculate that maybe there, because we know that hair color is determined by multiple genes, it could be possible that certain genes are penetrating and making gene products in childhood, that, and then later on maybe more genes come on board. That's the only thing I could suggest.
And then some people go gray very young, others don't.
Yeah, that's also considered a genetic trait. It's thought to be passed autosomal dominantly, meaning that if one of your parents has it, premature graying, you have a 50-50 chance of getting it as a young person. In the Caucasian population, around age 30 is when people start to notice some gray hairs. Probably around, they usually quote the number 50% of men are 50% gray by age 50. So that's when you'd have the salt and pepper hair.
Although sometimes the hair on the head will go salt and pepper before the beard, and vice versa.
True. You know, it all depends on how it all depends on how quickly the hairs are dividing, and how much damage is done to the melanocyte, the pigment-producing cell, with each successive round of hair growth. Because every time a hair is made and the hair falls out, you have a new round of melanocytes that are being formed from the stem cells. And each time that happens, there's some loss of the original reserve of stem cells.
My guests are Dr. Michelle Hanjani of Columbia University and Dr. Peter Frost of the Inter-University Center for Aboriginal Studies and Research in Quebec. And we're talking about hair on today's Please Explain. Dr. Frost, a listener writes in, there were a few poems about the Romans' love for blonde hair. This is my favorite by Juvenal. I believe the golden hair that Gula wears, she swears 'tis hers. 'Tis hers, she swears it, and true she swears it, for I know where she bought it.
Yeah, well, the Romans would buy their hair. There was a trade, a very lively trade, with the Germans and the Celtic tribes for hair. And this went on. It continued into the Middle Ages. And then people began to develop means of creating artificial blonde hair. Like hydrogen peroxide, which became popular from the 19th century on, and then other dyes in the 20th century.
Steve from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, there was talk about less hair or balding, or, you know, a bald head being a sign of masculinity, except that lots of hair can be a sign as well, like Tarzan has long hair, a lot of wrestlers have long hair, the biblical story of Samson in the Old Testament had long hair, and he lost his strength when it was shaven.
And Paul McCartney has not been the same since he cut his hair.
Right.
So what about that?
It depends on the situation. If you want to be attractive to women, it's better to have long hair. If you want to intimidate other men, it's better to have very short hair or even have no hair at all.
So is that why some men, especially athletes, will shave their heads completely because they want to look more fierce?
Yeah. And this is like it's a constant in many cultures. Warriors are often very close-cropped or they have no hair at all.
Would I be indiscreet to ask how long your hair is?
It's about 2 to 3 inches.
In other words, your standard haircut.
Yeah, I'm close to metrosexual, but yeah, standard.
Dr. Hanjani, a listener writes, is it true that we have tiny parasites living in our hair? I've heard they're called Demodex mites, and they live in our hair follicles without causing any ill effects.
It's true that some people do have an organism called a Demodex mite that lives in their hair follicles, and it's controversial whether Demodex is related to rosacea. I think that's kind of up in the air at this point. But as far as we know, in most people, Demodex doesn't seem to cause any trouble, and it's an incidental finding on a biopsy.
We have gotten a lot of calls and emails on this one. I'll just read this one to represent them all. Help, I think my handsome boyfriend is balding. Is there anything we can do to stop this? Is Rogaine the answer?
Yes, so in men, there's Rogaine and there is Propecia. So Rogaine is the trade name for minoxidil, which is now a generic product. And minoxidil is applied twice daily. We don't know why it works, but it was originally a blood pressure medicine, and the patients who took it for their blood pressure suddenly idiosyncratically developed hair in unusual places. And so they formulated it into a topical medicine, which was originally marketed as Rogaine, and now it's gone generic. And applied twice daily, probably two-thirds of men and women, it can be used in women also, will have either maintenance of their hair, meaning it won't continue to shed, or they will have increase in the density of their hair when applied to the scalp.
Women also want to know why their hair thins in middle age.
So in the story in women is not as well understood as the story in men. We know that there is some component of this DHT, this stronger male hormone, that does lead to shedding in women. It's also thought to be an autosomal dominant trait, as it is in men. It's just that perhaps the thinning isn't quite as obvious in many women, so they don't notice it. So there is probably some role of genetics or some role for hormones, but we don't really understand entirely what's going on in women.
What about bad hair days? Are they legitimate things? Can humidity, for example, make hair get frizzy?
Definitely. Actually, the shape of our hair, so when a woman washes her hair and blow dries it, the final shape of the hair is determined by these weak hydrogen bonds. So when you have wet hair and you put it in curlers, you get, and then you dry it and you take the curlers out, you'll have these small curls, and those curls are due to these weak hydrogen bonds. And as if you go out into the humidity, the water that's in the air will gradually break those hydrogen bonds, and then the hair will change its shape. So in a woman who has curly hair and blow dries it straight and then goes out into high humidity, the hydrogen bonds will reorganize into frizzy curly hair.
Another listener writes, is it true that the use of SSRI antidepressants can cause balding in women?
It is true that many medicines that are used to treat different disorders such as depression or anxiety, different mood disorders, can trigger shedding in women. Usually it's a telogen effluvium. It's very common, and It's not universal. It doesn't happen in all women. And sometimes it's very subtle, but in some women it can prevent them from taking medicines that they need.
This subject is so rich, we couldn't get to all the questions about, for example, whether red hair is caused by skin pigmentation, whether curly-haired people shouldn't use shampoo. But maybe we will address it again sometime in the future. But I want to thank both of you so much for being so informative. Dr. Michelle Hanjani, Assistant Professor of Clinical Dermatology at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Peter Frost, Associate Researcher at Inter-University Center for Aboriginal Studies and Research in Quebec. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, one of Brazil's most prominent climate scientists fills us in on the effect of the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. And then on our underappreciated summer reading series. Actually, on our underappreciated series, we will be looking at the work of Austrian writer Stefan Zweig, whose novels were popular in the 1920s and 1930s until his literary career was cut short when he had to flee the Nazis. Also, a fictional look at how the U.S. government might bolster claims about imaginary weapons of mass destruction by a former Time and Newsweek correspondent, and a gritty documentary about life and death inside a hospital in the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Bridget Bergen, Julia Corcoran, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.